In some ways, I wanted to be like Camus. I wanted to have a simple, straightforward style. In other ways, I was very attracted to the complexity of Flaubert's worldview and his ability to kind of combine romanticism and realism. And Stephen Crane is just so American. It's just so wonderfully different from anything, you know, I had read before.
And now, after all these decades, can you look back and still say that you were influenced by them, or what other influences might have crept into your work?
Well, I think everything I read is an influence, and there's sometimes when I am working on a book where I have to not allow myself to read, especially writers who have a very wonderful, strong style or voice, because I'll start to try to imitate it. A writer who's had a great influence on me in the last years has been J.M. Coetzee, a South African writer. To me, his style is just worth study. Sometimes I just look at his sentences and read them over and over, just trying to figure out how does he do what he does. So, yeah, he's a pretty important influence. I guess we're noticing that they're all men, and there's nothing to say about that. I don't know why that's the case, but I certainly like many women writers. Edith Wharton was a big influence at one point, and of course Doris Lessing and Joyce Carol Oates. I read them in college and later in graduate school. The big girls.
Now you say they're all, those original influences were all men, and yet your books really are very much, most of them have very, very strong female protagonists. I spoke to you before on Writer's Voice about Trespass, your penultimate Yes. book, and that was about a kind of confrontation between a privileged upper-middle-class mother and her son's girlfriend, who is a Balkan refugee, quite on the other end of the social spectrum, and yet somebody who's kind of taking a place. And then there was Mary Riley, which was told from the voice of Dr. Jekyll's maid, and another novel, Property, was told from the voice of a slave-owning woman in a time when there are rumors of rebellion. These seem very much themes where women of privilege and women who are not privileged are in some way confronting each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I hadn't thought about it that way, but it certainly is true that in each of those cases, there is a woman who has power and one who doesn't. And Mary Riley, of course, Mary Riley has no power, and her boss has two personalities. So that one less so, but certainly in Property and Trespass. I like the idea of doubles, and doubles, almost all my books have one kind or another of a doubling going on, that one character in some ways is the shadow or the dark side. Or in the last book about actors, the actor Edward Day has a double who even looks like him and who saves his life and tries to steal his girl and get his parts because they're both actors, they look alike. So that's part of why you see these two women characters, one with power and one without, confronting one another. It is that thematic motif that I like. But all the writing that I've done, I think, has had to do with situations that where one person has power over another person, or where there's something at stake, because those stories interest me. Those are the stories I like to, kind of stories I like to read.
Mm-hmm. And they are very much stories that speak to a women's position.
Yes, well, women's position. It both never changes, but in fact, in some ways, has changed. One thing that I have consciously done, especially in a couple of collections of short stories, is to look at stories written by men and then rewrite them as a woman who is attracted to what's going on in that story. Sort of put a woman in it is how I describe it. I take a story that I like and put a woman in it, which is essentially what Mary Riley was. I'd always loved Jekyll and Hyde. That's such a beautiful little novel. It's a joy to teach. It's very modern, very way ahead of its time. People just don't realize what a jewel it is. And I just was reading it for the umpteenth time and noticing this maid who was in it, and I thought, there's a woman in it, and decided that there might be a story there, that I would put a woman in it. So that's what I've done. I've done that in a lot of short stories, actually.
What do you mean that it's modern? What makes a modern novel?
Well, I think it's formally innovative. The story is told from three different points of view. The first part of it is, I'm trying to remember, it's been a long time since I've read it now, but The first part of it is just a conversation that goes on between two lawyers passing a wall, and they're talking about the doctor who lives on the other side. And then the last part of it is Jekyll's own confessions, which are not really trustworthy. So it plays with the whole idea of narration, of who to trust, who to believe, of a document, of documentation, and it also has a lot to say about class. But I think formally, it's for its time, I think it's rather experimental. Mm-hmm. And so that makes me describe it as a very modern little novel.
So here you're fascinated by the theme of power. Are there other themes that illuminate your work?
Well, the last few years I've been writing about artists a lot. I wrote a collection of stories called The Unfinished Novel and Other Stories, which is all about artists, writers, painters, actors, dancers. It was in that collection that I began to get interested in the whole notion of an actor as a character I would like to investigate. And so then I later wrote a whole novel about an actor. And I think it's an interesting and sort of rich soil to work in, because artists are so, well, they're doubled. You know, they have these two lives, their ordinary life and the life that they live in their work. So that appeals to me. And there's just so much angst and anger and jealousy and drama in the lives of artists, although it may all take place in a very small realm that most people wouldn't want to enter, especially if they have good sense, that it's rich. It's good stuff to write about. I've been enjoying that.
It's funny that you say that, because I recently interviewed Gail Levin, who wrote the biography of Lee Krasner. And I actually know something about that society, because Jackson Pollock's friend Harold and promoter Harold Rosenberg was a good friend of my parents, and and they, you know, they lived in the Hamptons, and I had no idea of the scandals and the jealousies and the, you know, the rages that went on between all of these people.
Yeah, it's really great to find out what really goes on in the lives of artists. Somebody like Pollock, where you look at the paintings, I mean, you got to look at the paintings and think there's some chaos here. So maybe in a way it's not such a surprise that his life was like that. But I think all artists are, you know, because the goal is so noble and high, and the actual business of it is so mean and sometimes narrow, that it really is hard on the psyche.
And it makes for great fiction.
And it makes for good fiction. I mean, the stories, if you spend any time talking to almost any artist, the stories that you hear, you think, let me just go and write that down, just what they're up to.
Valerie Martin has been teaching writing to college students for 20 years. She teaches now at Mount Holyoke College. I asked her how much writing good fiction depends on having a gift, or depends on the kind of instruction you can get.
Well, my teaching has probably changed a bit, just because my experience of writing caused me to think about it in some different ways. I think I'm a lot more relaxed about what's possible. You know, I've come to think of writing as a gift, and I've also come to think of it as a kind of, it's a way of seeing things. And if you see things that way, you write. If you don't, you can't. And so it's a way of making sense of the world. And some people are really driven to make sense of the world through fiction or through stories, while others would like to be writers, but they really have no desire to make sense of the world in this way.
You know, that's interesting. And there's also different kinds of writing. I mean, I tried my hand at fiction. I'm a nonfiction writer. I feel very comfortable with nonfiction, even creative nonfiction, possibly the most comfortable of all the genres. Fiction, I just couldn't imagine how one can inhabit totally different characters, and I realized I have no gift that way. So is that something somebody like me could actually learn, or really is that an innate gift?
Well, I think what you said, I couldn't imagine, is all you need to know. If the notion of entering a character, not yourself, is unimaginable, then I would say it's going to be pretty difficult to ever do it. And it really is a sort of turn of the imagination. I mean, when I read a story, I'm attracted to the characterization and I'm interested in how the writer has caused me to respond to the character the way I do. So I really respond to a writer's skill as a writer, but most readers of fiction respond to the characters as if they were real. And this is sometimes very disturbing. I have an email in my box right now in which someone who read Trespass writes to me and says, how could you kill this character? She was the only intelligent, insightful, caring, good person in the book, and you killed her. Another person wrote about the same character being killed. I was chastised. And she said, I just wasted my whole afternoon reading your book. How could you kill Chloe? She's the most interesting. And those useless men. So this is a real gut response to the work. I mean, when I read a book in which a character is surprisingly murdered or dies, suddenly my sense is, so that's what he decided to do with that character. I never identify with characters in this way that some readers do. So it makes me think that to be able to do it, you have to have both ability to identify and imagine, as well as this distance, which is always conscious of creating a character, because I'm trying to create a believable character. And to me, that is a complex person. It's never a simple person. So I'm not expecting readers to react the way they sometimes do. But I assume that they react the way they do because I succeeded.
How do you create a believable character?
Well, I think characters are complex. I guess the difference would be, how do you create a cliched character? Everything is on the surface. Everything is expected. Or if you read a detective story, you know, the detective is very much a detective. Sometimes he'll have a little hobby or something, but he's basically a kind of stock character. So I guess when I think of what you're calling, and I'm calling, a believable character, a complicated character, it is somebody who is beyond the stock character and beyond the cliche. How do you do that? Well, you've got what they say, what they do, and what they think, and that's all you've got. So I just try to go with that and stay with it and give them the courtesy of thinking that their responses are not going to be always what one would expect.
So there's an element of surprise that's needed for the reader.
It is for me. I mean, I love it when a character surprises me when I'm reading. I think, oh, she did that. I think, oh, don't do that. I really love when you're reading a novel and the character's doing something, you think, don't do it. When I was writing Mary Riley, I sometimes got her from the desk thing. You know, don't you see? Can't you see what's going on? Yeah, it's that. It's that element of surprise that comes from, and to me is the most pleasurable part about writing, of having, you know, realizing that in some ways you know more about a character than you thought you did.
Well, that makes some sense to me. And I wonder if in some ways some of that can be taught, because I think maybe the failure of the imagination might partly come from feeling that you don't have the right to imagine what another character might have thought.
Yeah, I like that. That is a notion these days, especially since I write historical fiction sometimes. And if there's a real character in the story and I imagine myself into his head, I'm doing that right now with Arthur Conan Doyle, there are readers who think, how do you have the nerve to imagine yourself into someone's head? But, I mean, my view is, what is your imagination for? Are you supposed to always sit locked in this box that's your own head and never leave and have everyone else in the world be a mystery to you? I mean, it's true that that sort of is our situation vis-a-vis other people, but a piece of fiction is a place where you can actually have this play, this playful freedom of imagining yourself into a head not your own. And I think I have a perfect right to do it. I'm not hurting anyone.
So tell us what you're working on, if you can. Some people don't like to.
It is historical fiction, and it concerns a ship, Mary Celeste, which was found in 1872 off the coast of the Azores. And it was in perfect condition, but there was no one on it. The crew had disappeared. It's a very famous naval mystery. And that's sort of at the center of the book I'm working on, but it in some ways is not the only thing the book is about. But that's how I got started.
That's great. Now you're going to be giving the keynote speech at Right Angles Conference 2011?
That's right. I didn't realize it was going to be called a keynote speech. It's not really going to be much of a speech. But I'm just going to talk about writing historical fiction. I taught a course here a year ago in writing historical fiction, and I just had a ball. The students were really good and excited. Many of them were history majors. And I'm sort of on a crusade now. I think that it's a good thing for writing students to try to go into the past and find a story that they want to tell and do a little research. It's very good to do research and to learn how to do research. So I'm just going to talk about writing historical fiction and what I do and what one does and what some of the questions about historical fiction are. And especially that question that you raised of imagining oneself into the head of someone who actually did live. Do we have some obligations to that person? Some people say we do.
Well, interestingly enough, that's exactly why I started to write fiction. I was actually writing a nonfiction book and thinking, there's a small story in that book that I'm writing that is a story of a young woman of which there is not a whole lot of information. But she had a very tragic end, and she seems to have a very amazing, you know, interesting, kind of ironic, difficult place within the story. It's a great story, but there's so little that she wrote. You know, it's really a book about a group of men, and the women were very incidental. It's almost like Mary Riley.
Oh, you found a woman in it.
Exactly. I put a woman in, and that's what stumped me, kind of like, how do I really know what she thought? Am I dishonoring her? So what kind of rules or things might I want to think about to free up that imagination?
Well, I think if you create her with interest and affection, you will not dishonor her, and she's dead, so she really won't care.
Yeah.
I mean, there is that, you know. When once we're under, we it's all over. I was at a conference where a history professor who was very vexed. It was all historical fiction writers, and this history professor was interviewing us and doing panels. And he was very upset about people who put actual historical figures in their books and suggested things about them, such as that they were homosexual, which one of our writers had done. And he thought that, you know, you just have no right. These people are dead. They can't defend themselves. And I said, well, would it bother you if you did that about somebody who was alive? Mm-hmm. And he said, no, because they can defend themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, I just don't think that's a very good reason.
Well, Valerie Martin, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.